The viewpoint was also that if a war did break out in the Middle East or in Iraq, there would be an implosion in the Middle East.
The aftermath of this war could be very messy and could indeed backfire on the United States and those directly involved.
Donald Rumsfeld is already preparing for how to attack North Korea.
Tony Blair has been called Bush's poodle. I think that's unfair. I think he's more like a Great Dane or a Border Collie.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, February 4th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Bush administration's plans for war remain on a fast track, despite the fact that key members of the UN Security Council, France, Russia, and China, have refused to endorse Bush's agenda. U.S. soldiers in Kuwait practiced storming a mock village in the desert in combat training for a possible ground war. According to today's Washington Post, over 100,000 U.S. troops are expected to be deployed to Kuwait within a few weeks. Foreign diplomats are pulling out of Iraq and Kuwait as the region braces itself for a possible attack from the U.S. Tomorrow, Secretary of State Colin Powell will make a crucial bid for U.N. support and is set to present so-called evidence that Iraq has hidden large caches of weapons of mass destruction from international inspectors and defied calls on it to disarm. Powell himself admits there will be no smoking gun, but promises to lay out a, quote, straightforward, compelling, and sober demonstration, unquote, that President Saddam Hussein is evading weapons inspectors and hiding large caches of weapons of mass destruction. Powell's presentation tomorrow to the Security Council will be the centerpiece of a strenuous campaign to enlist support from Russia, France, and other skeptical governments, and perhaps most importantly from the American public, three-quarters of whom are not yet convinced the U.S. should wage war against Iraq without U.N. approval. The international response to his briefing will largely determine whether the administration decides to seek a second Security Council resolution authorizing an invasion of Iraq or whether it decides to ignore the U.N. and act unilaterally. Norman Solomon, executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, has visited Iraq several times in recent weeks. Solomon is author of the book Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. We asked him about his impressions of the Iraqi people as war looms large on the horizon.
From what I can tell, both officials and people in the streets, it's pretty grim. I went there first in September with Congressmember Nick Rahal, and I think back then there was a lot more hope that something could be accomplished in terms of averting a war. I was back in December and then again a couple of weeks ago, and with each visit, this sense of doom, I think, has intensified. There's just a sense that there's no pleasing the Bush administration, that they're hell-bent on war, and that's what's going to happen.
Can you talk to us a little bit about the so-called diplomacy, others have called it arm-twisting, that took place within the European Union over the weekend as several former opponents of the U.S. war plans joined with Britain in taking the U.S. side?
Yeah, I mean, the United States is able and has been quite effective at brandishing carrots and sticks, both at the U.N. Security Council and with the European Union. And part of the power of being such an enormous economic and military force on the planet, I think, is all wrapped up in this capacity to engage in what we in other contexts would acknowledge as bribery, blackmail, deceit, all kinds of processes that get the White House what it wants. And I think this is unilateralism by any other name. There's been an outcry, including from folks in the peace movement, that you can't go it alone, that the U.S. should not go it alone. I don't really think that that's an appropriate stance to take, because when a country is so powerful as the United States, it can essentially impel, compel, or force other nations to line up sufficiently to claim that there is an alliance going on, that they have allies to go to war. Let's keep in mind that the war on Vietnam by the United States was, according to the White House at that time, a multilateral action. You know, we were told how Asian countries supported the U.S., how Australia, New Zealand had troops, South Korea had troops. That was just a smokescreen for the fact that it was driven by the United States.
Mm. Well, many of the those supporting President Bush's agenda for war have said they're not going it alone. They have, you know, half of Europe lining up in President Bush's camp, so to speak, and they seem to make a distinction between Europe, between the old European allies of the U.S. and the newer allies, basically old Europe like France and Germany, and the new allies like Belgium. Is opposition from the former allies really as insignificant as the Bush administration seems to be painting it to be at this time?
Well, I think part of the dynamic is that while the U.S. may be able to browbeat and induce half of the governments of Europe, the White House has only a small fraction of the people of Europe. You know, Turkey is an example. You've got perhaps the government, it seems, going along in a major way with the war effort, but you have polls showing upwards of 80% of the people flatly opposed to the U.S. war on Iraq. You go through Germany, France, Britain, with Tony Blair so emphatically in the main in support of Bush, and the population, the polls are showing, strongly opposed to going to war. And by the way, you know, Tony Blair has been called Bush's poodle. I think that's unfair. I think he's more like a Great Dane or a Border Collie, but that's an aside. The main point is that if you have governments, whether in the Security Council or the so-called diplomatic arena, lining up behind the U.S., it may, in fact, take place in that way, but their populations are overwhelmingly opposed to going to war in the first place.
And what about the smaller countries that have agreed to support the Bush administration's agenda? How much weight do you give that?
Well, I think it's PR weight. You know, many of these smaller countries are dependent in one way or another on the United States. And when the Security Council vote came a couple of months ago, there was enormous arm-twisting and understanding that IMF and World Bank loans and other sorts of economic aid would be hanging in the balance. So the United States is able to buy this image, this window dressing for war making.
So what is the Bush administration likely to do at this point with regard to the issue of unilateralism? Do you see them going forward with the allies that they have managed to identify, or is it likely that they will try and wait for some sort of endorsement or vote from the UN Security Council?
I think the U.S. is proceeding with unilateralism under another name, and to the extent they can line up support, which I think they're able to get from clearly a number of governments, they're going to invoke and laud that support as showing the United States is part of the world community. But in a sense, I think what we have is a kind of a new version of unilateralism. I think the U.S. will go for another resolution in the Security Council if the fix is in, if they're able to at least prevent a veto from France or Russia or China. But underneath it all is a kind of a isolationist view that the United States government decides, then it brandishes the carrots and sticks, often behind the scenes quite viciously, and proclaims its unilateral, isolationistly, if that's a word, arrived at foreign policy and war policy as being some kind of multilateral action. And I think it's not only transparent, it's extremely dangerous, because we hear from the White House about the need to stop rogue nations, but there is no country in the world as dangerous as the United States when it comes to being a rogue nation, and of course no country nearly as ready, willing, and able to inflict massive political violence in the form of war to achieve its geopolitical ends.
And what would be the consequences for the U.S. if it were to move ahead unilaterally without the full endorsement of the U.N. Security Council? Who would call the U.S. to the carpet?
Well, I think metaphorically, in a sense, the United States wants to redraw the psychological map of the world to create an expectation and certainly a tacit acceptance that what Washington wants, it will more or less get with some titration and fine-tuning around the edges. I think there's a feeling when you look at the writings of people like Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and so forth, that they've been gunning for this for a long time. And a key question is whether any significant sector of the so-called leadership in the Democratic Party, for instance, is going to say anything to oppose this, or whether under the guise of being the so-called world's only superpower, we're going to have this extremely powerful, unprecedentedly powerful military force, the Pentagon, able to serve essentially as a rogue nation unto itself and inflict enormous violence on people elsewhere in the world to suit the geopolitical goals of the White House.
Norman Solomon, Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and author of the book Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. While the U.S. proposes to use as much weaponry in the first 2 days of bombing Iraq as during the entire Gulf War, according to a New York Times article, Pacifica Radio commentators Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen review the administration's plans for war with Iraq and the devastation that is likely to follow, as well as the environmental impacts on the region.
Maya, the Pentagon's war plan for Iraq, according to the New York Times on February 2nd, now calls for 3,000 precision-guided bombs and missiles in the first 48 hours. They've already talked about 800 cruise missiles within 48 hours. That is to say, within minutes, they will use more tonnages than were unleashed on the Iraqi people during the entire 40-day period of the Gulf War.
This tonnage is concentrated on the people of Baghdad. The Ministry of Defense in Great Britain admitted on February 1st that the electricity system that powers water and sanitation for the Iraqi people could be the military target, despite warnings from the United Nations and others that destruction would cause a humanitarian tragedy.
In which 13 million Iraqi children are in immediate risk through the destruction of water, electricity, food supplies. But one of the most extraordinary things about this is the revelation in Aviation Week and space technology that microwave weapons or HPM weapons will be loaded into the cruise missiles, which will have an enormous radioactive effect and will be electronically capable of eliminating all electrical and electron-based communication systems, the infrastructure of the society will be devastated within minutes.
Now, one issue has been who is going to rule Iraq once the United States occupies. And, Ralph, I think you have the latest information on that.
Well, the Washington Post has disclosed that the U.S. war planning has reached its final phase, and that's part of a secret national security presidential directive signed by Bush, putting the Pentagon in charge. It means that General Tommy Franks, the theater commander for the war, Rumsfeld's designated person in charge of Iraq, will take control of the entire country after the oil has been seized, the population subdued, and the disaster inflicted on the population at large.
This is stage one of a permanent war. It was revealed in the New York Times that U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is already preparing for how to attack North Korea. And in Parliament, British Prime Minister Tony Blair, during a torrid question time in the House of Commons, admitted, quote, "After we deal with Iraq, we do, yes, have to confront North Korea." And what we have here is Donald Rumsfeld, according to CBS, revealing that Admiral Thomas Fargo of the U.S. Commander in the Pacific has requested the buildup of U.S. forces, and that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld is meeting with the commander of American forces in South Korea this week.
Preparatory for phase two of the permanent war, not just Iraq, North Korea. It's a long-term effort at the destruction on a huge scale. This is Ralph Schoenman.
And Maya Schoen.
Pacifica Radio commentators Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen and host of Pacifica Station WBAI's Taking Aim. British Prime Minister Tony Blair met today with French Prime Minister Jacques Chirac, but failed to reverse France's opposition to a British-American invasion of Iraq without approval from the United Nations. Dr. Peter Goen, editor of the New Left Review, spoke from London today with Robert Knight and Amy Goodman of Pacifica Station WBAI's morning show, Wake Up Call. They addressed the tete-a-tete between Blair and Chirac, as well as the European view of a possible Anglo-American war in Iraq.
it's absolutely vital for Blair that when the war actually starts, France is at least neutral and preferably backing it. The crucial thing for Blair at the moment is to get France to come over to support a new resolution at the UN Security Council. If Blair goes into a war with the United States, with France and Germany in open opposition to the war, this will make the situation for Blair, not only in Europe, but in Britain too, very, very dangerous.
What are the hidden factors here? To what extent is a French desire for continuity of oil contracts with Iraq a factor?
Well, I think that is a factor, or let's put it round the other way. I think that France feels that if the French government feels that if it does not in the end go along with a war, it will be completely shut out of Middle East oil by the United States. And that, for France, is a serious concern. On the other hand, I don't think it would be right to assume that this question of oil is the only thing that motivates the French government. There is a different conception in France from the British conception, both of the kind of international order we want, and also the politics and the role of the European Union in international affairs. In addition to that, I think the French government does feel that the consequences, the aftermath of this war, could be very messy and could indeed backfire on the United States and those directly involved in the Middle East. And so that's another factor in French thinking.
What is the attitude in the British military?
As far as the military leadership's concerned, it's very hard to find anybody who's enthusiastic about this war. On the other hand, amongst the civilians in the Ministry of Defense, there is clearly a lot of support for the war. One of the very unusual things for British politics, which makes it very different from United States normally, is that in British politics, usually the top civil service makes sure that the British government and its different ministries all speak with one voice. But in this crisis, we've had repeatedly direct conflicts between words spoken by officials from the Ministry of Defense and those from the Foreign Office and other parts of the British government, with the civilian leadership of the Ministry of Defense being very, very close to Rumsfeld and the civilians in the Pentagon.
What has been the communication with Germany and Gerhard Schroeder, and how firm is the Franco-German resistance to a precipitous war?
As far as Blair is concerned, he knows that Germany is not going to openly support war at the UN Security Council. And there is no real attempt to pull the German government onto a different position, onto positive support for war at the Security Council. It should be said, of course, that Germany is allowing the United States to use German military bases, but there's no serious attempt to pull Germany over. The big question is France, and it's an extremely difficult issue for the French president, this issue. The Blair circle believes, evidently, that in the end, France will behave as it's traditionally behaved and will in the end come over and support, or at least go neutral. And all the British efforts are really directed at the moment to pulling France over like that.
One other nation, Russia, has also shown some reluctance, and perhaps has even more of a bit of leverage with the dependence of the United States with the Columbia tragedy on the shuttling and ferrying provided by the Russian space program. How strong is the Russian resistance, and does this give any more power to it?
I think that Russia is not going to threaten to use its veto alone at the UN Security Council. And Russia has supported the French position, but if France moved, I would be very surprised indeed if the Russian government would stick out against war in Iraq.
Dr. Peter Gowen, editor of the New Left Review and professor of international relations at Metropolitan University in London, where he spoke earlier today with Peace Watch producer Robert Knight of WBAI. Thousands of activists in the U.S. and the United Kingdom organized an International Day of Action today, protesting at over 100 gas stations and calling for Americans and Brits to reduce dependence on oil. We checked in earlier today with Jason Kafouri of Democracy Rising and UnitedForPeace.org, one of the organizers of today's demonstrations.
We, along with Target Oil, have organized today a day of action across the country here and across Europe, where more than 100 gas stations are being targeted on the theme of no war for oil. We do not want to have a war started so that the multinational corporate oil interests can gain more access to Iraq's oil and at the expense of thousands of lives. We're at a huge demonstration in front of the American Petroleum Institute. We've got a 20-foot high oil barrel that says "Don't bomb Iraq" on it. We've got all kinds of media here. We've got drums. We've got street theater. We've got the ExxonMobil Grim Reaper 10-foot-high puppet in black, pouring black oil everywhere. So it's quite a spectacle, and I think we're getting a clear message sent that this war should not be about oil. You know, we're targeting hundreds of places. Some cities are doing as many as 50 gas stations alone. I know that's happening in Tucson, Arizona. We have events happening in at least 20 or 30 different states here, at least a few different countries in Europe. I think it's been a tremendous organizing effort, and it's really happened quite fast. I think it shows that there's an enormous amount of opposition to the U.S. launching a preemptive unilateral war about oil.
Jason Kafouri, national coordinator with Democracy Rising, describing today's international protests with the message of no war for oil. Well, anti-war protests, vigils, and demonstrations have been taking place all across the country over the past several months. Peace Watch has spent the past few days checking in with people involved in several of these actions, and here's what they had to say.
My name is Eric Weltman, and I'm the organizing director for Citizens for Participation in Political Action here in Boston. We are involved in a host of actions from vigils to rallies to forums that are done with an effort to both mobilize activists and also do outreach to ordinary citizens and encourage them to take action against war in Iraq. In Massachusetts, there are now over 30 local grassroots peace groups that on a regular basis hold vigils, hold forums, do leafleting, tabling, outreach, and we're involved in working with and assisting a lot of these groups. Many of these groups are just holding regular vigils in their town centers, maybe 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 people, and the response they're getting generally is incredibly positive. I mean, people are holding signs, of course, and they're getting, honks, cars honking in support, people taking leaflets. Obviously, you get the occasional, rude gesture and what have you. But in general, the support has been incredibly positive. We helped organize one in Somerville last Friday that in the most bitter cold, we had over 300 people. And that's one of the interesting contexts is that we have perhaps the coldest winter in 100 years here in Massachusetts, and nonetheless, the turnout at some of our outdoor events has been remarkable nonetheless.
Nebraskans for Peace has chapters at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, University of Nebraska at Lincoln, Nebraska Wesleyan University, and in Omaha and Lincoln. The Omaha and Lincoln chapters have weekly vigils. We're also working as part of a coalition in Lincoln, the Coalition for Peace, which organized a demonstration on January 18th in which there were 1,000 participants. It's a pretty diverse group of people, for the most part, in opinions about what we should be doing. I mean, there's people there that participate that want to silently vigil, and there's other people that want to be very vociferous. And then there's people that feel that it's time for us not only to be in the streets, but it's time that we're doing nonviolent civil disobedience, and to be doing everything within our means to nonviolently oppose and hinder the Bush administration and the military's plans to kill innocent people.
On January 18th, more than 200 folks from Eastern Maine joined 400 others who traveled by 12 buses to Washington, D.C. to say no to the war in Iraq. And folks came from as far away as Lubeck on the Canadian border on the east and Presque Isle and Aroostook County in the north. Each week, we have people in more than 20 communities around the state holding peace vigils. And some, including the one here in Bangor, have been continuing for more than a year. And we find that many people who drive by honk in support, and each week a new person joins us, so it's great. Yesterday, we held a press conference to announce the formation of a statewide coalition called Win Without War. And this coalition brings together the Maine Council of Churches, National Organization of Women, Physicians for Social Responsibility, as well as other statewide, regional, and local peace groups. And today there's a press conference being held as we speak in the State House in Augusta to announce a joint resolution from the Maine House and Senate urging the President to support diplomatic resolutions and weapons inspection. And next week the City of Portland will be voting on a similar resolution, and resolutions will be introduced in Bangor, Orono, and other Maine towns as well. I'm Karen Dolan. I'm a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and I also coordinate a project called Cities for Peace. Currently, we're at 57 municipalities nationwide, and tonight we expect about three or four more. Portland, Maine is voting tonight, and Royal Oak, Wisconsin, and I believe Hamtramck, Michigan, and Cambridge, Mass. So it's growing quickly. We had about 22 cities at the beginning of January, and now after tonight there'll be about 62 with over 70 more campaigns underway nationwide. So it's a grassroots movement that is just catching fire and really appealing to citizens who are feeling frustrated, who are feeling that their voice isn't being heard at the federal level, and are doing all that they can to make sure that democracy works and that their deep skepticism about the war is registered at the city level and delivered to the federal level.
I'm in Helena, Montana, where I'm a photographer and an art activist. I was asked by a group of women to be the photographer for their nude peace protest. And so a week ago, I went out into a mountainside meadow where 50 women arranged themselves on the snow on top of prickly pear cactus, which seemed to be everywhere in this valley, and spelled out the word peace. We really wanted to symbolically place our bodies between the weapons of destruction held by our own country and those who would be the victims if the United States initiates another war against Iraq. We got the idea from the women in West Marin County, California. We think that we were the third or the fourth group to do this action. And the symbolism is that we are making our own selves vulnerable, especially in the winter, and especially for many of the women who are not upfront political activists. A lot of them have never modeled in the nude for a photograph before. This was a frightening thing, really, for them to take off their clothes and be photographed. And so in doing that, they were very conscious of their own vulnerability, and thus they were identifying with those who we feel would lose everything, even possibly their lives, if the war in the Middle East escalates. Today, the men are making plans to do their own nude peace protest, and that plans, I really want people to know that this isn't an isolated incident, that we are doing many other things, from petitioning and lobbying and letter writing and protesting with banners in the streets to communicate this. It's been very interesting how much attention this nude peace protest has gotten, and we will continue to wage this struggle.
Just a small sampling of some of the thousands of creative strategies to protest the impending war. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.